I have the amount of material is elaborated because of the responses to what happened last time. My name is Andy Gordon. This is the third in a series that somebody else named What's True. I'm trying to talk about interpretations of information and understandings of reality from the point of view of some experiences and some studies and some opportunities I've had. The first time we talked especially about how accurate records are in organizations and what makes them inaccurate, how it is that people turn out when they provide a service, for example, or do a duty, where what they write down about what they do is often quite different from what they actually do. How does that occur? What does it tell us? What can you do with the information there? What pressures are people under such that such a thing might happen? You can go a long distance with that, and that's a subject I'll be doubling back on some future talks. Last time, we used one study, which some of you, nobody at that time knew about, some of you may, called the Behavioral Study of Obedience by Stanley Milgram, where he was able to provoke some rather extraordinary behavior from human beings merely by a few modest manipulations of the environment. In the situation that was about, he was able to get people to deliver potentially lethal shocks to one another only because there was an authority figure present. These were shocks being delivered to people they didn't know. They were being delivered in circumstances that don't seem particularly compelling. But when the authority figure was present, this kind of behavior was manifested among huge numbers of people. In his case, in a relatively meaningful sample, 68% of the people seemed to be able to deliver and be willing to deliver lethal doses of electricity to one another. It's a striking study, but it takes a long time to lay out. The reason I brought it up here, there were two particular things that were relevant to what we've been talking about. The first was that this is the kind of behavior none of these people would have expected from themselves beforehand. Who among us would say that I would be one of the people that would deliver such a shock? And yet it looks like the circumstances with modest manipulation invoke that kind of behavior from a lot of people. There are really three things. The second that I want to point out for what we're going to do tonight and in the future is that when you asked experts, people who supposedly had some knowledge of human behavior and how it responds to various conditions, what would have happened, the highest prediction you could get of the percentage of people who'd be willing to do this was 3%, not 68%, but 3%. Nobody thought that those among us were capable of such behavior. Our predictions were quite extraordinary. And the third thing was that the only situation in which they were able dramatically to suppress the extent to which people were willing to deliver the shock was when the authority figure left the room. They had a situation where there was a meter where they were supposed to be reporting the level of shock they were delivering, and they systematically would lie to the authority figure, this supposed scientist in a white coat. And the question becomes, are they lying? What does it mean to call them liars in that situation? When somehow, as Milgram put it, they were unable to invent another response to let them escape from the situation, but they were able to lie. It was the best way in which they could provide their own moral behavior. Now, or what looks to observers' moral behavior. And once again, these people didn't believe it of themselves, and typically saw scientists wouldn't have believed it of them, even people who observed. Well, I don't want to go more into Milgram, although I think there's a lot more conversation we unfortunately had to end from things people have been talking to me about since. Let me give you another study that's sort of in the same domain. Again, I'm going to give you a very abbreviated version of it so we can move on to some other things, which I meant for the topic of tonight to be. But it studies of something called bystander intervention. Do any of you remember the Kitty Genovese incident in New York? It really got a lot of people going. There was a woman in Kew Gardens in New York who was raped and killed in the middle of the night, but she screamed so loudly that hardly anybody could pretend not having heard it. And in fact, when they asked people in the neighborhood, there were over 100 people who admitted to having heard the screams and having done nothing. Does anybody remember this? It was happened in the late 60s. It got a lot of attention. There have been a lot of events since then. But this particular one got some social scientists to work on the event, because the editorials that were coming out saying how the urban situation would produce this in anybody, and why is the world going to hell in a handbasket, and so on and so forth, they thought might be amenable to a bit more systematic analysis. Now, again, I don't want to, this is not to be the focus of the evening, although I'll be glad to answer questions about it if they come up. They did the following. They said, what's characteristic of that event? Well, one thing that's characteristic is that there wasn't only one person who could have observed. There were 100 people. Might that have had any consequence? Very briefly, let me run you through a couple studies. One of them, undergraduates are invited into a room. They sit down alone or with a bunch of other people. They're supposedly filling out some sort of questionnaire. It really doesn't matter what it is. It's all a ruse. But while they're sitting there, what appears to be smoke begins to roll into the room through a vent. It's really I forget what they've used. It's nothing dangerous. But they don't know it's not dangerous. There's just a vent. And there's this stuff coming in through the vent. And all the and the people go on filling out their questionnaire, and all they're interested in, the experimenters in this situation, is do they report it or not, depending upon whether they're with themselves, by themselves, or with other people when this happens. Now, the only thing they've varied is whether you're sitting by yourself or you're sitting with somebody on the other side of the room. The smoke billows so significantly that at the end of 2 minutes, people are wiping the smoke out of their face so they can see the questionnaire while they fill it out. I mean, this is, and of course they've got a lot of reasons they provide for themselves about why they're behaving like this. This is just an experiment, et cetera, et cetera. But these are all things that are similar across all these conditions, whether there's somebody else or not. When people are, when somebody else is in the room and this happens, 68%, it just happens to be the same number, 68% of the people report the fact of a potential fire. They just leave the room and say there's something going on in here. Report the fire in 2 minutes or less. Typically it's right away or not at all. When a person is in the room alone, that's 68%. When a person is in the room with one other person, only 10% of the people report it. Just putting another person in the room who you've never seen before, who's sitting on the other side of the room doing the same thing, induces this tremendous difference in how willing or how much people respond. They then spun this out in a lot of other ways. They did it where somebody seemed to be having an epileptic attack in another room, where somebody fell off some, seemed to have books fallen down on them, et cetera, et cetera. There are a lot of conditions under which it was changed, but in fact, in every case, adding one person who doesn't do anything has a tremendous impact. Now, think of the condition with the epileptic fit. People, if they were alone, would typically get up right away and say, no, I don't, and then these people were debriefed afterwards, and they go to the door and they say, excuse me, can I help? Or they'd say to the experimenter, not wanting to make a fool of themselves, this is probably a joke, but somebody seems to be having trouble in the other room. Now, if you ask people why they reported, they will always tell you what was the right thing to do. It might have been a mistake. It might have been a ruse after I'm in an experimental laboratory. But in fact, the only thing that they all say that when they report, as if the only thing provoking them is the behavior they hear in the other room. the noise, the falling, the smoke, whatever it is, as if that's the only thing that matters. And yet you can more that you can multiply by more than 7 times the number of people who say that about their behavior merely by having them be alone rather than be with somebody else. So we have moral explanations for the behavior that's going on that seem to be tremendously induced by the environment we're in. The two kinds of explanations that these people gave for this, that anybody who wants to follow up, there's a wonderful series of studies by some men named Latané and Darley. And it's the explanations they give are, one, diffusion of responsibility, right? Why don't I do it? Because, I mean, the Kitty Genovese situation, what happens if you report it? You got it. Surely there are 100 other people watching. Any of them could have reported it. Everybody imagines that somebody else is doing it. If it's important, it's going to be acted on by somebody. And in fact, Kitty Genovese would have been better off if only one person had been there to see it than if all those old people were there. That managed to suppress the likelihood that anybody would do it. So the fusion of responsibility turns out, at least as people give explanations to themselves after the fact, to explain a lot of the behavior, but this is not an explanation that was available to them. And another one is, the other major one is, this is the one I want to focus on, so I can't even remember what the other one was. Just a second. Pluralistic ignorance. And the reason this is important is because, and this is one that a couple of other people have developed, the way this was spun out is that you would be, if you were in a laboratory in these situations with a stooge, that is somebody whose job it was not to be nervous, to be purely passive in spite of the noises they heard, in spite of the smoke, that would provoke people even less frequently to report anything because they would read the other person's non-concern as meaning they shouldn't be concerned. A mask of non-concern. Have you heard this about people walking? There's this same guy and others have developed some things. This Milgram we talked about yesterday has talked about the urban situation where, have you noticed how people have a very passive face as they, how unlikely they are to say hello to one another, how much they try to cut things off by acting as if it's not part of them, by carrying sort of a mask that this is not their territory. They're going from here to there no matter what else is going on. Well, if enough people are looking passive and unconcerned, that's the message they're passing to one another. And so they read one another's lack of concern as what they call pluralistic ignorance, and so they misread one another's cues. So the fact that nobody knows what's happening means, for example, that if there are two friends in the room, they're more likely to act. But the reason seems to be that they can read one another. They can tell whether one another seemed to be nervous. It isn't the facts of this I'm interested in for the purposes of this week that I'm developing, so much as two things. First, these are behaviors nobody would have anticipated, as in the Milgram situation. It has a tremendous impact on how people act. And second, if you ask a person after the fact why they behaved the way they did. For example, they always would say to the person, if they were in the room alone, what would you have done if you'd been with somebody else? And they looked at you as if it's the dumbest question they've ever heard. Why should another person's presence have anything to do with whether I act for a person in need? If you ask the person that's with somebody else, would you have acted if you were alone? I said, well, it obviously wasn't an emergency. What difference would it have made? So there's this tremendous influence that people doesn't seem to be accessible as a category of explanation. That's the central direction I want to develop in a variety of ways, because this is something that in classes in social psychology, it turns out to be very useful. There are some people who have said we're not logical animals, we're psychological animals. We look for psychological explanations. We look for explanations among things we observe. So, for example, if somebody, this is what I've called the iceberg model, if we see somebody act in a certain way, then we tend to attribute that behavior to something else which we have observed about that person. Okay, he's grumpy, he must not have had a good meal. or he must have gotten up on the wrong side of the bed, or something that's immediate. When in fact, there seem to be a lot of things. Well, I'm not going to do much of this, so. Whereas there are a lot of things that probably provoke behavior that you just can't see. They're not available to you. They're not categories of explanation that you bring. So why did this person leap up and do something? Because it's part of their moral code? No, because they were alone in the room. It's not among the categories of explanation that people carry with them. There are a lot of things like that, and I'm going to embarrass some of you now by doing, at least I'm going to ask you to engage in a task which is tough, and I'm not going to explain it to you until it's over, but then I'll try to tell you why I did it. Okay. Now I'm going to hand everybody, everybody for whom I have enough of these, it's a napkin. The only way you can get out of this is if you don't have something to write with. And all I'm going to ask you to do is pass these around. All of a sudden, nobody has anything to write. As it turns out, that's your explanation. This is all I'd like you to do, and we're going to go ahead and talk about some other things while you do it. But I would like you to do the following. More napkins, more pencils, right? There are more napkins in the corner, too. Don't worry. Look. I would like you to take the paper, draw three lines about like that, or some size, and then I would like you to write your name. Now, listen to me carefully. The directions are you have to do it slowly, very slowly, what seems to be painfully slowly. You have to write it, not print it. Write your name, don't print it, and do it so that the big letters fill the whole space and the little letters fill the bottom half. And what I'm asking you to do is write your name. Write it out. Very slowly. Following those directions. First and last name. Don't print, write. I have to give you a few minutes to do this before we can talk about it, but I'd like some people to give it a shot at least.
On the
use
of the paper,
it doesn't matter. Well, give yourself, it has to be long enough for you to write your whole name. Now, you write large, you know, it's going to have to if you're going to fill the spaces and you've drawn the lines the way I've asked. Big letters fill the whole space, small letters fill half the space, your whole name. Slowly. Let's have some people do it. If you're on to your second name, your last name, it's much too fast. Much too fast. There are no right or wrong answers. Yes. I don't want to say anything more. I mean, just interpret what I told you to do. How are we doing, Kate? Have some people tried this out? This is not a test we'll be able to test rigorously today, because this isn't a setting that's appropriate, and because you'd actually have to look at some other work. But I'll tell you what the frequent response to this is. What does this remind you of? Anything? First grade. If I were to ask any of you to sit down and write your name the way you wrote it when you first learned, you wouldn't be able to do it. You'd clutch. You say, how can I remember that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But setting the context in this way allows the muscles, forcing you to write slowly, forcing you to write on, did you notice what the paper looks a little like? Newsprint, that's why I chose it. Most of us learn to write on what purple or green lines or whatever they are on newsprint, very large. Frequently what happens is when people do this, and they take it seriously, it's hard to get rid of the embarrassment involved. But take this and then check it against their first books where they learned to write, it's very similar. I frequently have married women who write their maiden name without even knowing that's what they're doing. But because by the time they get to their last name, they're in gear. Now the issue here is that there's all kinds of information available to us inside that we can use for a variety of activities, but it's the idea that you have to set the stage. And if you set the stage, it's available. Now, if it's available for peculiar things like this, some people have argued it's available for a lot of other purposes too. We're still compelled by some of the same, there's some genetic reason why this information is still encoded within us. It's there. And it motivates us, and I'll get back to some of that later. I try it out on some people that haven't been here to hear the explanation, because even now I didn't give you enough time. But this is frequently the consequence of setting the stage in this way. There's some people who've actually used this strategy to do therapy. Setting the stage in this way. There's a psychiatrist who, for example, now this is some years ago, I don't know whether it's still happening, who would take grown-ups. Remember, one of the things they often try to do in psychotherapy is to get you to be back when you were very young. What he does, instead of having people lie down on a couch and recall when they were very young, is put them in an oversized room with oversized toys, in an oversized crib and diapers, and leaves them for 2 hours. And then he comes back and asks them what it was like when they were that age. There's something compelling about being able to set the situation that lets people pull out of themselves information, strategies, things that otherwise don't seem to be available. Okay. Let me move this along one other direction. There's a very important social psychologist named Roger Brown, who's done work in a lot of areas, mostly on language. Terry were here, he'd know about his work. But I want to focus on fascinating stuff of his called the tip of the tongue phenomenon. And again, I'm using all these as ways in which one can extract information about the way the physiological system of the body seems to have information, code information, and make it available, that has led to some very interesting understandings of information processing by human beings. Typically, information processing is looked to be this heady venture that people deal with in a non-empirical way or by looking at children and how they talk, for example, but there's this whole other way of thinking about how information is stored and how it might be made available that I'm trying to present to you in the time we have. Now, let's talk a little about this tip of the tongue phenomenon. Does everybody know what a tip of the tongue phenomenon is? Do you know what I'm talking about? When something's on the tip of your tongue? It's an odd state to be in. But it's a state where you can't quite recall something, but you almost can. You don't quite know what it is, whatever it is. What he did was sit down with a bunch of fellow faculty and look through a dictionary and come up with a lot of words that seemed to induce in some of them the tip of the tongue phenomenon, as he called it, where he'd read a definition and the person would go, can't quite think of it, and then all of a sudden they'd say it. Now there's no word that does that for everybody, and there are some words that do it for nobody. What they did is develop a list of about 100 such words. So let me try out a few on you. Don't say anything if you know the answer. What is the name of the Japanese boat that people fish on, not a junk? Don't say anything. Not a junk. What's a Japanese fishing boat? Who's got an answer?
Is it sampan?
Sampan. Now, if you knew the answer to that all right away, you're not relevant. Because you weren't in this tip of the tongue state. If you had no idea what the answer was, then for this word, you're not relevant. If you were searching when she said it, the word you were trying to think of wasn't that word, then for these purposes, you're not relevant. What he would do is give everybody a sheet of paper with a bunch of lines, and they were to write down every word that occurred to them while they were looking for the word that he was trying to induce this tip of the tongue state in. Okay, and they would therefore have, as far as he was concerned, the filing cabinet. What drawer did you look in? What did the words you found have in common with the words you were looking for? Okay. What, now here's another one. What's the name of the extract from a whale that's used in making perfume? Now, what would happen, and remember he's reading lots of these words, and he's then when people think they know or think they're looking, not know, when they're looking, they're supposed to write down where they're looking. And then he calls time after about a minute, and it declares what the word is, and if that's the one you were looking for, then you check, and so on and so forth. Then they collected all the information. What do people think it is?
Ambergris.
Ambergris, right. Now, again, it has to be true when you pick such a set of words that a lot of people don't know a lot of them. And some people are looking for some of them, and those are the only pieces of information they're interested in. But what they found was really kind of fascinating. Well, what do you think? Where do you think people look? If you're filling out a file cabinet to look for a word like the word you're after, what do you think that file cabinet is labeled? What does it have in common with sampan?
What do you think?
There are a lot of rhymes. It could be rhyming. It could be homonyms. It could be synonyms. It could be first letters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It turns out that the most common thing that the words you have are, the most common way in which they're like the words you're looking for is they are the same number of syllables and the same rhyming pattern. So sampan, most people's first words would have been baba of some sort. And ambergris, ba ba ba. Okay. Then they'll look for sound alikes. And then they'll look for first letters. So there are ways in which what he was interested in knowing is something rather complicated about how people seem to work could be understood in this way. And he found lots of stuff. Now let me tell you one of the things that I'm going to get back to later that turned out to be the most interesting. He also tried to find out something about the people who were tested, you know, who were put through this mill. And he found out that the people who were nominated as creative by the others, people who everybody said, they're the creative bloke, had looked in very different places. They dipped into their brain in a different way. So their associations were really strange by other people's lights, and yet, you know, I'm not trying to draw cause and effect, but I am saying there was this very interesting finding about how people people thought by others to be creative, tended to have information organized inside their head. Yeah?
Can I just share something? I was testing a first grade student this year, and one of the questions from the psychoeducational test was a picture of Abraham Lincoln, and she was to identify the person. And she said, it's on the tip of my tongue, you can't speak. She said, give me the number. Okay, I'll go to the numbers. 16, she said, Abraham Lincoln. That just surprised me. I didn't have time to say that.
What was the number?
16th president.
Oh, I see. Oh, my God. Did you try her on any other present to see whether that was the...
Well, they had, I went back to her teacher and they had discussed that in February.
Well, kids are always very interesting in how they work. I mean, it's I think one of the things, one of the major things we do is homogenize everybody so that I'll bet you kids are more likely to have interesting organization patterns than the rest of us are. When our daughter was 2 years old, she gets hot easily. And we were trying to, every time we would put, let's see, when we wanted to take her out so she wouldn't get too hot, we put shorts on her. And so she, there's a while there when she kept resisting putting shorts on. She really screamed when we tried to put shorts on her. And then later when she was able to explain it to us, it was because every time she put shorts on, she gets hot. Which was true, right? Because we only would put shorts on her when we were going to take her into the heat. But she had her cause-effect mechanisms a little screwy, at least by the way we look at things. Okay, so let me just remember this thing about creativity and the fact that this was sort of derived in this peculiar way, this understanding of creativity. There's also some very interesting experiments that one wouldn't do unless they were necessary. In brain research at another level, this is the only thing I'll talk about that's like this. They were started by a man named Penfield in Canada. I don't know how many of you know about Penfield's work. It's really very interesting. What they've done is brains had to be exposed for some reason that wouldn't have been, some operation had to take place or something. And then they will take some electrode that delivers a very small current, and put those electrodes at various places in the brain. Well, there are places that are said to be memory locations in the brain. And if you take, he found that if you take this current and deliver it to a particular place, that all of a sudden the person has a deja vu experience. They recall something from their past in what is apparently real time. That is to say, it runs at the same speed that the event seems to run. The information is stored there in vivid detail that if you were asked what had happened at that time, you wouldn't be able to report on. Now, if you take the electrode and move it somewhere else, just slightly into a different place and turn it on, you get the reporting of a different event. It's deja vu is the proper description because people know they aren't reliving it, but they sense it as if they were living it. For some reason, this strikes me as the most peculiar part of all. If you turn the electrode, if you leave the electrode in place, turn it off, and then turn it on again, it's just like you rewound the tape. The event starts again from the same spot in time. So this information is stored in apparently magnificent detail. But it isn't. It obviously isn't frequently being recalled by us in any way that we understand. Apparently, there are some sources to what are called the more primitive parts of the brain that evoke all kinds of images only when they're available. People know about the sense of smell in particular, right? Remembrance of things past talks about that especially, how smells will evoke all kinds of things that are sensations. Well, whatever the sensate basis is, the people are operating on is apparently very rich and very interesting. Now, there are a couple that I'm trying to get back to truth, but I'm coming through a variety of angles. One of them has to do with if I had asked you to write your name as you wrote it in the second grade, let's say this came out for some of you, and you had told me that you weren't able to. Would that be true? It's true in a certain sense. That is, the occasion has to be presented to you. But it's not true in another sense, because if the occasion were presented, this is information that you could derive. If I ask these social scientists whether or not people would be willing to shock one another outrageously, and they tell me they can't, they won't, it won't happen, people aren't like that, they're not wrong in some sense, they're wrong because they don't know any better. What about the people that were willing to lie? That is to say, to deceive the scientists in these modem experiments. What about the people who told me that it wouldn't have made any difference had they been in the room alone versus had they been in the room with somebody else? In a sense, it's not true, but in a sense, it's not to blame them. I'm trying to draw out various strategies that make you understand that truth is an ephemeral quality when it has to do with the things that influence our behavior, especially the way we behave toward one another. And there are a lot of physiological roots to this. Okay, there are a couple other directions I want to develop this in, but are there any questions so far? Is there anything?
I just want to comment on that thing you said about the geisha. Really, that's a phenomenon that can happen to certain people with certain types of epilepsy. And that's something that happens to certain people. They have a geisha phenomenon. There's also, in some people, a sense of certain smells or certain visions, and usually they see that those, like for instance, the sense of smell, will usually go back to some kind of smell that happened in the time of trauma when that person was injured, when their brain was injured.
Right. So some things are coded more deeply, more intensely than others. That's true. There's a lot of things like that that we just don't have time to get into. Yeah.
I was talking with a fellow who's named. Not tipping my toe.
Quick, right.
He was a brain surgeon and a brain researcher. And he would say something like, you can't, what you just said, like there's something encoded in the brain. Mm-hmm. He said you can't prove that. They act as though, or they say things as though something's coded in the brain, but we got no proof that anything's coded in the brain. What we, to represent it accurately, you would say that when you put this electrode here, someone says something or someone sees something. So it's as if something were coded in the brain, but there's no, that's an explanation itself.
Right. No, that's a good point.
So I just want to, when people are hearing something is encoded in the brain, there's no absolute evidence for that. That's a kind of an assumption or you said apparently a couple of times. It's an apparency, but there's no direct evidence.
Well, but there's evidence of this form as I understand it. When somebody is poking at my brain and I'm lying down on a table, I don't see where they're poking.
Yeah.
If I completely map the memory part of the brain so I can precisely place an electrode, I place it somewhere, turn on the current, and record an event. I leave. I come back. And with the same precision, I put the electrode in the same place. They report the same event. If I put it in another place, they report another event. They don't know. It's like a double-blind experiment. They don't know where it is that I am because they can't see it. So something is happening at the neural level. Now, whether or not, I'm not trying to use heavy-handed terminology, but there's something going on that can be brought out of somebody with a neural impulse when it's delivered to the brain. It is hard. It is, we probably, in matter of fact, and I'll talk about this some when we talk about computers in a couple times, we probably don't have the terminology at all to describe what's going on in the brain. I mean, that's why most of our artificial intelligence solutions are foolish. I mean, we don't know how intelligence works. How can we possibly mimic it with a machine? So you're right to caution my wording, but there's something going on that is in the brain, whether it's encoded is the right term or not. We do know that the capacity of the brain to respond to things like this is true. That is, we know what happens to memory under certain conditions when the brain is split or with a lot of lobotomies and so on. We have predictions of what people are capable of doing with respect to memory.
Yeah, this fellow also said that there are evidences of where there are parts of the brain removed that would apparently remove some memory. There was some time where the memory was recovered.
That's absolutely right.
Even though that part of the brain that's, quote, memory was removed.
Yeah.
And part of people's brain that was supposed to be associated with optical or oral or whatever motor function was removed over some period of time. At least that's what this guy said, that these people recovered.
You can recover. That's quite clear. Even in split brain experiments, where you sever them absolutely, one side of the brain can learn to pick up operations that used to be only carried by the other side, as far as I can tell. So there's a remarkable recovery impulse.
I don't know. See, that's also another assumption. I don't know if there's any recovery. It's just that's what happened. It calls to question certain things. I don't know.
Right. Well,
it's amazing. What I'm hearing is how much we jump. We observe something and then we come up with an explanation, and then call that the way it is.
Right.
I'm not so sure it is or isn't.
Right. No, that's a good point. I mean, that's really what I was pointing out.
Assumptions.
Right. Well, there are going from experimental evidence to something that you can say absolutely is really tough in all these situations. There's a man I worked with that calls this the primitive prehistory of a science. You know, and I'd say it's absolutely true that we get caught up in the same things that we seem to be studying, right? But I also think that I can point out that there are some things that people aren't even aware of as things that are going on in their head. That is, information that is somehow available.
Something's going on.
And we also know that it can operate remarkably quickly. There's apparently, I don't know whether any of you have been following some recent work on the sense of color vision, cones and rods. Apparently, in this, that those cones and rods, whenever we see colors, but the colors are obviously sweeping very quickly when I move from one side of the room to the other, because I know that's blue and I know this is blue and it changes in my field of vision, and yet every bit of that is a chemical reaction. The cones and rods for various colors are differentially sensitive to proteins, which are releasing impulses, so that chemical reactions can pass as quickly as I can move my head with all the complexity of what's going on. So the capacity of us to deal with information input in a way in which we can understand it is also really remarkable.
This brain theorist said one more thing. He said in order to give the brain every power, to attribute the powers that we attribute to it, it would have to have at least one more synapse connection than the highest number, the greatest number you could come up with. Basically, he said it, you know, kind of like inside of it, they have to be outside of it. It's impossible to explain that. This is a brain theorist.
Right.
It's impossible to explain the functions of the brain with the brain.
Right, the brain. Right, okay.
You literally got to have one more than the highest number you could ever come up with.
How does he know that?
Well, exactly. But what he's saying is that the theories are to be called the question. I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
No, I understand. No, I think.
But what he's really saying is you've got to be listening kind of questioningly rather than answeringly,
right,
if you will, to what's said or to what we're working on.
Right.
Like that.
Well,
because our theories always come up a little bit short.
Sure, well,
like a chalkboard, it's cartoon chalkboard. Physicists had this whole long formula, and right in the middle it said a miracle happens and then continues on.
Right.
It's like there's some assumption that every one of the theories are based on, and that assumption is some kind of faith or some kind of assumption.
Right.
Some sort.
Right. That for me doesn't become isn't sufficient to dismiss this evidence for me about how people behave, for example, in these social situations, which is somehow more compelling to me because it's all right in front of you. I mean, there's either one other person in the room or there isn't. They either get up and scream emergency or they don't, you know. And they always say, it's smog you introduced to make me feel bad, or this is truth serum, so I'll fill out my questionnaire properly. But again, those explanations are equally available to both sets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, let me, I'm not going to get this all done. Let me push in one direction that is about deception, deceiving others, deceiving oneself, with two different kinds of examples. Are people aware of what lie detector machinery is, what it does, what it looks like, what it supposedly accomplishes? Who, anybody want to tell me what they think it is, what it measures? Do you think it works?
It measures physiological changes. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. What are people's general? I mean, do you know how much these are moving into industry and the economy? Reagan wanted to test everybody, and Schultz, wasn't it Schultz? Somebody at the very top said, "I'll quit first." Many industries are hiring people they're paying $300-$400 a shot to get these expertly administered lie detectors. Does anybody know why do people think that they work? What makes them seem like an instrument worth attending to? Yeah, it measures, they try to measure a lot of things, including heart rate, pulse, rhythm, and so on. And one of the major things is what's called GSR, galvanic skin response, and that's really just a measure of the conductivity of the skin. Many of you may be aware, or if a person lies, they often sweat more. Well, it's just reducing that down to the F degree and trying to make it scientific. That even if a person is lying a little bit, they sweat a little bit more. And what you're measuring is conductivity, because if you're sweating, the saline solution tends to conduct electricity, so the current goes up, and what you're measuring is changes in currents. Well, let's imagine that it worked. In the first place, there are some very interesting experiments recently where they got, where they would say somebody in this room is lying. Somebody, what was it, something on 60 Minutes recently where they said somebody took the typewriter? And in fact, nobody took the typewriter, but the professional experts could always find the one who took the typewriter that wasn't missing, right? I mean, their job was to find somebody, and they could always find somebody. Okay. Now, but what would this require, among other things, in order to be successful? What's the one thing that would have to be required in order for this to work at all? A person would have to think that they were lying. Right? If a person has no cognition or awareness that they've told a lie, then you can't, you're unable to measure the fact that they're lying for you, because it's your reaction to the fact that you're not telling the truth that supposedly provokes this response. Okay, there are, for example, first I want to talk about a general category of people for whom truth seems to be an issue. Sociopaths. Do people know about sociopaths? Sociopaths, I don't want to get into terribly technical explanations today, but essentially they're people who are described often as not having any conscience. That is, they behave in ways that are very instrumental. They do whatever seems to work, and that's the only thing they're relying on. There's a man named David Licken, who, among other things, is, I think, one of the one of the, he's from Minnesota, by the way, as are half the Lutherans, I'm finding out. It's the University of Minnesota. Licken, being a foremost expert on the lie detector, doesn't believe in it. Also has done a lot of work on sociopaths, and he has some fascinating findings. If you take most of us and put some gadget, any kind of gadget that's measuring changes, nervousness, let's say, on us, and do a variety of things, like that. Or shoot a gun. Or threaten to draw some blood. Or tell you that somebody just died. There are very different manifestations of how much you respond. So that somebody knows to some extent what the provocation was. So if it was a minor thing, you'll get a minor reaction. If it's a major thing, like somebody points a gun at you, you're likely to have a major reaction. Okay. With some stems to be what some people, they call it veridicality, some sort of relationship between our reaction and what seems to be the provocative stimulus. Sociopaths are nothing like that. For the sociopath, if you look at a graph, no matter what you're doing, including throwing that device or threatening to draw blood, it's always the same. They don't seem to have any feedback from their bodies that's telling them anything about how they should respond. So you get these tremendous, and by the way, it's not that although these people are typically thought to be placid, and they appear placid, that's not what seems to be going on inside. In fact, their reactions are tremendous. But they're tremendous and undifferentiating to everything. So they don't have this information that tells them, they don't have a feedback mechanism, as far as we can tell, that is the same at least as everybody else's, and their behavior is manifested in things that seem to be directed by things that go on outside rather than inside their body. Well, that's one kind of self-deception I wanted to bring up. But I wanted to do this in pursuit of one, I think I'm going to make it a final point, which is also about classes of people. You remember I mentioned about the creativity in the earlier studies and where people who were creative seemed to have these very peculiar reactions. They didn't look in the same drawers. Well, this is really very much to your point. It may be, and this is something that I've been thinking about recently because of some other stuff I'm about to present, that it isn't, the difference is not in what and where they look, the difference is in what they're willing to report. They're not inhibited from saying things that seem to be bizarre in situations where other people would feel inhibited. The reason, and that creativity is by this way of looking at things, available to all of us. But it's just that some people suppress it and other people don't. I think that fellow means we're supposed to go on. Let me make one more point. This most recent stuff about self-deception is that there are also people who it looks like repress the truth to themselves. So that if you ask them whether they behaved in a particular way or they saw something happen, if that thing provokes them, they'll say no. They're not, if they are lying to themselves, it is not only at the manifest level, it's at the physiological level. Because it's also true that the chemical, that other people, when they lie, seem to be evoked chemically. But a whole class of people that are called repressors don't seem to be. We seem to have the capacity to lie to ourselves in ways that aren't even available to ourselves. It's hard to know what to do with that when you're trying to draw up categories of people who are more or less truthful. At what level can you be held responsible for things that seem to be that inaccessible to you? It's almost, for this category, a little like race. It's something that, as far as we know, they can't change. So we have deception that seems to have, of oneself, that seems at least to have physiological correlates. We have deceptions that seem to be based in just lacks of proper understandings about the world that we've talked about a little bit today and a lot yesterday. We have deceptions that of oneself and of others that seem to have to do with the social circumstance in which you're located. I'm going to try to play all those out in a slightly different way and give some other examples of situations where deceptions are less likely to happen and what we're going to cover tomorrow.
Thank you.
That's right. I remember, in fact, I was working at Rockefeller University.
Yes, I was